Good afternoon and welcome to Saturday with Cormac O'Hara. On today's programme, bringing teachers home from the Middle East, sending our soldiers to war-torn Mali, and what they're paid to do what they do. In the week when a young man from Kilkenny was stabbed to death in the streets of Dublin, a former governor of Mountjoy Prison tells us we should be worried about the amount of knife crime on our streets. And as they gear up for the debates, can any other Tory contenders stop Boris? That and more, but first the news with Susan Jackson. Gramila Mogget, Susan, they're texting already, 51551, particularly regarding what pay soldiers get and what pay and treatment teachers get. And we'll come to that in just a moment. My panel today is Minister for European Affairs and Fine Gael TD for Meath East, Helen McEntee, Fianna Fáil spokesperson on defence and TD for Dublin West, Jack Chambers, Independent Senator Gerard Crochwell. Joining us from Limerick is Professor Niamh Hourigan, sociologist and vice president of academic affairs at Mary Immaculate College in Limerick, and former governor of Mountjoy Prison is John Lonergan. 51551 if you want to get in contact with the programme today. We know, we've heard in the news that a mother of three suffered a violent death in Mayo last night. And during the week, you will have heard that a young man was stabbed to death on O'Connell Street in Dublin. Now, I don't want to talk about these cases, obviously, for obvious reasons specifically, but more generally, I wonder, is it time, John Lonergan, to be worried about the prevalence of street crime and particularly knife crime at this stage?
Oh, God, it is. It's a very regular feature of news headlines now. Regularly, almost on a weekly basis, you hear of a serious stabbing. I came across a lot of it in my life in Mountjoy. A lot of it is impulsive. One of the things that I always say when I'm talking, especially to young men in secondary school, is never, ever bring a weapon with you on a social or on any outing. Because people bring them often not to deliberately harm somebody, but to protect themselves.
But you say it's impulsive. What do you mean? That the person who would carry the weapon or whatever wouldn't be aggressive or violent by nature or generally, is that it?
Yeah, often a simple mistake, a dispute, can lead to an impulsive action. For instance, two guys just start arguing and one loses the head a little bit and becomes a little bit violent. For instance, he strikes the other person. Now, if you have a knife, your immediate reaction is, I have something here, and instantly you will draw the knife. Now, when you draw the knife, you're depending on that person not to react to it. But if that person is high on drugs, for instance, or has a psychiatric difficulty, he will come right through at you. And of course, the response will be to stab. So it's often having the weapon. The best protection is don't have weapons. That is the thing. And we need to tell young people that.
And that's a life-changing event then.
That is
that
a disaster for two families minimum. The person who has carried out that attack is now wrecked for life because he's going to spend a long time in prison. He's going to be convicted of murder. He never intended to commit a murder. And the victim has his life taken from him.
We'll talk about that in just a second. Why are we talking about this, Jack Chambers? In a way, Fianna Fáil and you were telling us that this is happening more and more often now, and in the daytime as well.
It is, yeah. And look, some of the incidents have been absolutely shocking on our streets, and between gun crime and knife crime. And we also have seen a big increase in the Gardaí actually seizing knives over the last 3 years. It's massively increased. So clearly people out there are effectively arming themselves with weapons, whether it's guns or knives. And I think...
But is it something new, I wonder?
I think it's a growing trend. I think you have to link it up to issues around the drug problem. We've seen a massive increase in the level of polydrug use and in the cocaine intake. And I think a lot of it's linked as well to the gangland crime as well. So you've got two issues. You've got the, I suppose, homeless. So to an extent, you've got it's linked in with homelessness as well, where we had the incident last week. But also generally, you've got the gangland issues ongoing, where they're arming themselves up, they're spraying bullets around communities, and there's a clear law and order issue there.
Can I say this on your behalf, and before we get texted or called? Not obviously, not everybody who is homeless is involved in any way in drugs or in alcoholism or anything like that.
No, not at all. But there is an issue where where we on our streets, where people can see it every day, where there's a growing trend of homelessness and serious issues of poly drug use. And we've left a lot of these people without the interventions in the context of their addictions, a lot of them being left forever and for more on methadone programs without being given a prospect of recovery, being given the prospect of having a second chance in life. So they're in that cycle of addiction, they're in that cycle of drugs, and inevitably that will result in serious violent incidents occurring.
And we'll come back to the lack of services in just a second, but Niamh Horrigan, can I bring you in? Because almost invariably, and maybe it's insensitive, but when we discuss things like this and programs like this, people will say people have made their choices and they live and die sometimes by their choices, and it doesn't affect the rest of us, correct or incorrect?
Well, it may be correct, but I think it doesn't. It's not necessarily helpful, because it doesn't solve the problem, and it doesn't solve the need for society to have some kind of response to it. I think part of the problem here, essentially, in looking particularly at the way it's been perceived, is that the rate of death amongst homeless people, homeless men on the streets in particular, is so high. We had a study coming out from Trinity earlier on this year, which showed that it was 3 to 10 times higher in men in Dublin than in the normal population, and 6 to 10 times higher than women. I mean, in the last 6 weeks in Cork, you'd 3 men die on the streets. Mm-hmm. And even 2 years ago, that would have, I think, evinced a much greater level of outrage. I think there's two pieces to it. I think, first of all, when you do have more people on the streets who are very vulnerable and very stressed, and we certainly know that, and there is a confluence with addiction issues, I think the likelihood of violent events happening in that context is greater. But I think the other piece, in particular in relation to knife crime, it is not just the homelessness issue, but is also young people getting caught up in drug addiction and getting into conflict because of that. Because one of the things that drugs do is that they impact on your impulse control. And I think this was getting back to what John was saying, is that your capacity to control your impulses is much weaker. And if you are armed, or if you are oriented that way already, there's much more likely a conflict happened. It's interesting though, Cormac, to look at some of the parallels with the UK here, because there's a case being made in some of the emerging research in the UK where they have had a significant increase in knife crime. They are linking it to, you know, the scaling back of youth services and youth diversion services in particular. And I mean, those services have been hit particularly hard during the austerity period, and there hasn't been that much restoration there. And I think that's an area that we could look at in terms of addressing some of these issues.
A texter has said, though, knives, 51551, knives are not the issue. It's human behaviour that's the root issue. Deal with this at community level and it will decrease. See what has happened in London. Do you have any, do you agree with that?
I do, and I think we have seen a huge improvement. I think any incident is one incident too many, but if you talk to, and in particular, hospital staff or emergency departments, they will actually say that serious knife crime has gone down, that it's the lowest it's been since 2005, and that's for a number of reasons. It's, as Jack has said, because there's been a huge attempt by the Gardaí to seize knives. I think the figure that I read from the last 3 years is almost 5,000 were seized. But also there's a new approach in terms of, yes, enforcement. If a person is caught with a knife on them in a public space for no reason, the initial penalty or recently was 1 year, it's now as much as 5 years in prison if you're caught. But also the education piece is massive in all of this. Why would a young person be carrying a knife in the first place? We need to deter that and make sure it doesn't get to the point where A, somebody is hurt, and B, somebody ends up in prison, where, as was said already, both families, both communities and everybody is impacted.
But obviously education is either not happening or not working, because it's the seizure of knives by Gardaí has risen by 2/3 apparently since 2016. In 2018, nearly 2,000 knives were seized by Gardaí. So boys or girls or men or women are making a decision, as John Lonergan has said, to put a knife in their pocket or in their bag when they go to the streets. Why is that?
Well, I think that's something we need to try and establish. I mean, the fact obviously that the number of knives seized has increased is worrying, but the fact that the number of incidents has decreased obviously means that the Gardaí are doing their job,
it's
that there is a huge amount
of
enforcement. Well, I think we do. We need to look at all of the different issues. And I think, like a lot of people here, I've been watching many news reports every day. It seems as though there's a different incident in London, and we don't want it to ever get to the point where every day you're seeing different youths killing other young people and different incidents happening.
Are we
so
going
it's
in
a
that
matter.
Direction?
Well, I don't think we are, particularly if you see the fact that the number of incidents are decreasing. I think that's because, as I've said, there has been a level of enforcement. There has been stricter measures in place, particularly the 1 to 5 year jail term. I think that should be a deterrent, but obviously it's not deterring everybody.
Should
so I think whether it's at a younger age in primary schools or even beyond that, because we see it's becoming younger and younger that people are doing this, but also having more enforcement on the streets. We have a system in Ireland where most of our night time finishes at the same time. You have thousands of people coming onto the streets at the same time.
Sorry, and I know Gardaí, isn't this a problem? Knife crime is a problem in primary schools?
No, I'm saying about just making awareness, making this an awareness issue at a much younger age.
You say have education programmes in primary schools about knife crime?
I'm saying in general about protecting, making ourselves safe and making sure that we live in a safe environment, that it's not okay and it should never be okay to carry something like that. I'm not saying it needs to be a programme, but I think the younger we teach people that this is not an appropriate way to behave with anything, the better.
Well, why shouldn't it be a programme?
Well, why not? But, if it's not already in place, maybe some schools do have it.
Who's looking at that in government?
Perhaps it's something that we need to look at.
A texter, listen to this, Chair Crockle, you might respond. A texter has said, knife crime is at epidemic proportions. The public are no longer shocked to hear someone has been stabbed. Until the Legislators Act to amend the laws of sentencing on knife crime, nothing will change and more innocent young boys or men will lose their lives and families destroyed. Killers should be held accountable. Stop making excuses. It's too late for my son, but not too late to try to prevent further trauma to other families. Charlotte Nolan, broken-hearted mother of Sean Nolan, stabbed on Waterloo Road on the 26th of May 2007. Thank you for the text, Charlotte, and I hope we're not in any way causing you anxiety. We want to talk about it sensitively, and that's the problem, isn't it, Gerard Crockwell? It's real people who are heartbroken for the rest of their lives, isn't that right?
It is real people. I think John put it in context when he spoke. Bringing a weapon out with you on an evening or during the day, is there's a certain empowerment in it. I know I have this weapon in my pocket. I know this weapon is going to make me safe. I will never, ever, ever use it until I find myself in an aggressive attack when I take it from my pocket. There is a combination of things that need to go on here. Legislation is only part of the issue. My colleague in the Senate, Mary Louise O'Donnell, attempted to bring in minimum life sentence periods. I don't know how John would feel about that, but that those who murder serve significant period of time. We'll put somebody in jail for not having a TV licence, and yet we allow murderers to come out after as short a period as 7 years. So we need to look at sentencing. We need to look at the right of Gardaí to stop and search. We need to look at the education programme. And we need to teach our children, going back to Helen's point, the primary school kids, we need them to deal with aggression. I mean, it's not that terribly long ago, Cormac, since we saw a young man kicked to death outside a nightclub in Dublin. There was no knife involved there.
What do you mean about teaching people to deal with aggression? What does that mean?
We need to learn to handle aggression. For as long as man has walked the face of the earth, we have been aggressive with one another. We need to learn how to handle that. We need to be able to confront situations without resorting to violence. And I think that's something that can be thought.
What do you think about that, Niamh?
I think it's a big ask. I think there's, if we look at the broader trajectory of particularly where it's going in primary schools, there is, I think, a greater impetus about younger children in particular understanding their own feelings and recognising their own feelings and then taking that through the system. But I suppose I would always have a concern about something being said, well, it's the school's job to do it, because often kids, role model or copy the behaviours that they see as much as the behaviours that they're taught about. And I suppose
you're saying it's a parent's job.
I think it's everyone's job. I think it's a whole community job. Mm-hmm. But also I do think that it's important to recognise the inequities. I mean, one of the things, Cormac, that came across very strongly in the research that I did in Limerick a couple of years ago, which looked at kind of hyper-masculinity and precisely the kind of things that Gerard was talking about young fellas going out and kind of trying to be tougher than the next guy, which is often the root of these behaviours. Often young fellas who engage in that kind of behaviour are those who feel, well, I'm not going to get my status through the conventional system, so they find another way of doing it. And it is often about manifesting aggression and getting respect through fear. And so really you need the kind of hard strategies of setting boundaries with that, that Helen was talking about, but you also need the softer strategies of saying, look, there's other ways of being kind of recognised and valued within society without bullying people or intimidating people, which ultimately can end up, when you throw drugs into the mix, in these behaviours of pulling knives and the devastation that emerges from that.
John Lonergan, can I ask you about dealing with aggression and teaching young people to deal with aggression? At the end of the day, if you're caught with a knife or if you're caught in the act of harming someone, is the best thing to do zero tolerance and tough justice, or is it education and compassion?
I have absolutely no hesitation in saying that 99% of the people that carry out these offences are not thinking about the consequences. Young men in particular. Even if they're sober, they're very poor at consequences. If they're under the influence of alcohol or drugs, then it's zero. They have no perception of consequences. So it's impulsiveness. And I suppose another thing that I keep saying all the time, because I believe this at this stage, it's not all about information and education. Because if it was, we'd have a lot of social problems solved years ago. It's like, don't drink and drive. Look how long and it's still not registering 100%.
But the justice system, John, says that in the act of committing the crime, if it was a knife crime or whatever, that there's a mental element in the act, and they have deigned to say, yes, I will take this person's life, the mens rea element of the crime, and then there's the act. And when you go through the criminal justice system, the courts will test each and every element. They will say, yes, this person decided to take this person's life, and they acted upon that.
Yeah, I have no difficulty with the theory in relation to the nowadays acting recklessly is justifies a murder conviction, and I'm against that. A very important point to make is that the days of the 7 years for a life sentence are long gone, and the average sentence that people serve now is closer to 16, 17, 18 years if they get out at all.
16 years over taking somebody.
I'm not justifying it at all, Cormac. I'm just simply saying that, you know, the facts are that it takes, well, you know, most people serve 15, 16, 17, 18 years. Some never get out. The problem I have with all that is that is only dealing with an individual case where the person has committed a crime. And I've no difficulty with if that person stays in prison forever. But I'm not so convinced that in itself will act as a deterrent tonight on the streets, because I don't believe men, young men in particular, we know this from research. And finally, one other point, I think it's absolutely crucial to make this point as well. The whole technology thing, social media and all that stuff that's out there, the games that young people are playing, the violence that they're enjoying, I'm absolutely convinced that it is very detrimental to their well-being.
Well, they're very common, aren't they? Shoot them up games, you mean?
Yeah, exactly. And harming other human beings and getting enjoyment out of and getting rewards in a game. Now, we certainly need to look at that again and to say that is something that parents and everyone else involved in the development of children need to take it on. And I know, you know, from experience that a child of 6 or 7 who was on some of these technology games or whatever they are, and when you remove them by force, the immediate reaction is aggression. Mm. So there is a connection between the child's, whatever way the child has been indoctrinated with this stuff that's on modern technology.
Well, that's food for thought for an awful lot of parents, I think, listening.
We need to look at that in sport as well, in young people in sport. How many times have you watched young people's match where a parent would stand on the side of the pitch screaming, take him out, take him out?
Okay, well, I have a producer screaming at me, take him out for a second. I need to take a break. But Larry Donnelly says via Twitter, interesting points about anger and the effects of taking out the anger among young men in particular. It might be a highbrow solution, but boxing clubs historically have played a big role on this front. That's something that Jared is agreeing with, I can see. And Anne says, sweet Jesus, how could it fall to primary schools to teach about knife crime? Advice to teaching colleagues, stay in Dubai. Well, to bring them home or not, we'll discuss that after a very quick break.
Email saturday@rte.ie. Saturday with Cormac O'Hara on RTE Radio 1.
I'm with Minister Helen McIntyre of Fine Gael, Jack Chambers of Fianna Fáil, Gerard Crockwell, Independent Senator, Professor Niamh Hourigan of Mary Immaculate College in Limerick, and John Lonergan, who's a former governor of Mountjoy Prison. A texter, Liz, says, yes, aggression and mood control needs to be part of the schooling system because parents don't do it enough. So why depend on them? says Liz. Now, two things happened this week that may have caused you to raise an eyebrow or a remark. The decision to send our soldiers to Mali, to war-torn Mali. And also, on the other side of the public sector coin, Minister Joe McHugh decided to travel to the United Arab Emirates to talk to teachers, Irish teachers there, in a type of a town hall meeting, and ask them what exactly, Minister?
I think there's a number of things. It's not, as some people were suggesting, a recruitment campaign that he went over to try and bring people home. I think, like everybody here, I have family members and friends who are working in Dubai, who are teaching in Dubai, and some of them have gone because they wanted to. They had jobs at home. They left because they wanted a change and to move somewhere different. Others left because they couldn't get a job. Whatever reason they're there for, some of them who want to come home, whether they went in the instance because they wanted to or not, it appears as though it's quite difficult to come home and to go through that process to apply for positions here. And I think what the minister wanted to do, and he met with my sister-in-law when he was there, he met with friends of mine who were over there, was to talk to them from their position in terms of looking at coming home. What are the challenges that they face? How can we make it easier? How can we encourage them as well to come home? Because we do have a particular skill shortage in terms of primary school and certain areas in secondary school around Irish sciences and various other subjects. So how can we make it easier? And
but
I think
why is the government just singling out teachers? Is the same thing going to happen? Is the Minister for Jobs going to go and meet Irish construction workers in the UK?
Well, I mean, this happens across the board, and I think every minister, if they're not, should be doing something similar. If you look at my own department, and I say it in that people will say, well, you're sending people away. We have a huge shortage of Irish people working in our Parliament, in the Commission, in the European institutions, and we have a demographic cliff edge where people are retiring, and we need people working there. So I've been doing a huge amount of work in travelling to universities, in speaking to people in Brussels and in the institutions, in trying to help them and find out why is it so difficult, why do we not have people along the line getting through the position and actually being appointed. So every minister and every department should be doing the same.
It is not happening, isn't it? The government is singling out teachers in this situation and deciding to travel across the world to talk to Irish teachers on location in the Middle East. That's not happening to Irish construction workers working in Australia. No minister is going to meet with them in a town hall style meeting and saying, would you like to come home, and what is a major challenge?
No, I don't think that's the case at all. We have a minister for the diaspora who spends, that's his focus and his priority, engaging with people abroad. But you also have various different trade missions. I myself, when I travel, I meet with Irish people. I meet with people across various different industries and sectors. And you talk to them, and I talk to them, and I guarantee you, and I know that my colleagues as well talk to them about why they're there, the challenges that they face if they were to come home. And I think, I suppose, it's just highlighted now because the minister has decided to do it in this way. But Dubai or the UAE is not just one area. I spent, I think, half an hour myself on a phone recently to a young woman who has returned from Australia with her partner and two children, and she explained the significant challenges from her part as to how she got home, the challenges in applying for jobs here, the fact that she was in a different country. And it's about getting that first-hand perspective.
Well,
and I think that's what the minister was doing. Well, I'll give you one example.
Let me ask Jack Chambers.
Can I give you one example?
And I'll come back to you.
Yeah, no, so look, I acknowledge the fact the minister went to Dubai. There's a lot of teachers there, a lot of nurses who've left for there, and there's doctors abroad as well. And the government does need to have a broader conversation with the emigrant community who feel that they're excluded from working in the Irish public service. And a lot of that relates to the pay issues and the issues around pay inequality that have been neglected and ignored over a period. But also there's issues that have been presented to them. For example, they changed for the master's programme for education has gone from 1 to 2 years. That could be reversed back. A lot of that added a year to the teaching qualification, and also increase the cost implication for teachers who wanted to train. There's issues with other international graduates who are abroad who find it very difficult and bureaucratic to actually come into Ireland and teach here, they might be in international languages or other areas. So I think the minister, the proof of this will be in what he actually does. And I think that's what we need to hear from him on his return. Like, it shouldn't be just a photo opportunity and a discussion with teachers to pretend that he's attempting to do something. The proof will be in what his actions are after his visit. And I think that's the problem sometimes with government. We've got lots of engagements and meetings and talking shops. What teachers and doctors and nurses want is delivery on pay inequality, which has been constantly neglected over a period of time.
Is that the primary reason, the primary gripe, Gerard Crockwell? You spent years as a teacher rep in the unions, the TUI. Is that the main concern, I wonder?
Pay is certainly an issue, but if we're being honest about it, particularly in second-level education, we have failed to offer jobs, I mean full jobs, to teachers since around about 1998. We're employing teachers by the hour. And you will find young teachers that do come home. And I've sat in schools and I've met teachers who have a five-hour contract for the week. And they're expected to sit around the school and hang around the school hoping they might pick up a few part-time hours. Would you come home from Dubai for that?
That's correct. That is happening. But I think we checked this morning, there's around 1,500 permanent jobs available at the moment. I mean, that's nothing to be sneezed at.
Absolutely not. But you must remember that the population is growing as well. You must remember there's a significant number of teachers retiring each year. Listen, teaching as a profession has been downgraded systematically over the years. One of the latent aspects was of the contract of indefinite duration was the ability to employ teachers by the hour. The primary school teachers that go abroad for a very different reason. Mm-hmm. But teachers who wish to return home here, they cannot return home on the basis of a five-hour contract. They cannot return home on the basis of a 10-hour contract.
But how many of them, Niamh Hourigan, and you're training them, as they leave your college, they say, I'm getting out of Dodge because I can, because I can travel to a warmer climate, and it's a bit of an adventure as well, and I get international experience. I mean, what is wrong with that?
Well, there's nothing wrong with that, and I think that's very understandable. And for years, we've seen students from across the higher education sector, for instance, you know, during the Celtic Tiger era, so many of them went to Australia for a year after they finished college. So it's not unusual at all. I think the teacher supply crisis is coming at a pinch point between two different factors. One is changes in the sector itself, which was, you know, a big period of reform, much of which was very welcome, but did essentially raise the bar in terms of standards and expectations within the system. On the other side of the house, you had everything that happened in the post-2011 period. So you had the issues of pay inequality emerging, and also, being realistic and honest about it, Cormac, I think the particular pinch point created by housing and accommodation. I mean, you know, for instance, one of the subjects at second level, where there is very strong demand is Irish and home economics, and there's a whole range of vacant permanent positions, we understand, in Dublin in those areas, and they are finding impossible to fill it. I mean, the Deputy Principals and Principals Association in the TUI said in the past 6 months, 94% of them have experienced teacher recruitment difficulties, 63% teacher retention difficulties, and 68%, this is the statistic that kind of worries me most, advertised positions for which no teacher applied. Now, that, if you're a school manager, that is going to make your life very difficult.
Instead of trying to understand how it could be easier, made easier for Irish teachers in the Middle East to come back home, should we, I wonder, Jack Chambers, be making it easier for migrants living in Ireland to become teachers?
Of course we should. We should be encouraging everyone to become a teacher if they're capable and able to do so, and there should be equal opportunity on that. But going back to the point that Niamh made, that's one of the issues. When you actually discuss it with teachers who are here and working, like, I regularly meet teachers in my constituency who are in a house with five or six other teachers. If you go back historically 20, 30 years ago, you may have had a young couple, a teacher and a guard, or a teacher and somebody else who could actually afford to buy a home and had a prospect and a hope of living in the suburb to where they were teaching. Now they've been displaced out to the broader parts of Leinster if they want to teach in Dublin. They've got massive commutes of an hour or two into work. And it's just as a huge, the cost of living issue is really affecting them in terms of transport costs, accommodation costs.
That's housing policy over the last 20 years, isn't it?
Well, no, actually, teachers were able to purchase homes and...
Over the last 20 or 30 years, under Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil governments, it's housing policy that did that, and it's the concentration on Dublin and building Dublin up as an economic hub to the detriment of the regions. Oh, that's what caused that, isn't it?
No, but with a lot of people living in Dublin and working in Dublin, and we do need to broaden the spread of economic growth across the regions. I fully support that as someone who was born in Galway, and I think everyone acknowledges that, but... the fact that teachers are living in Offaly and Laois and having to travel up and down to Dublin, they're having to get up much earlier in the morning, but they can't afford to buy a home.
What do, do they want butter on both sides though? Because Anne in Galway says, Cormac, newly qualified teachers should have to work in Ireland for 4 years before leaving to work in Dubai. Otherwise, they should have to repay a percentage of the cost of their education to the taxpayer.
That's a race to the bottom.
Well, hang on. People say that by text as well about nurses and doctors and so on. In a way, her point is, why should we give them free education in order for them to leave?
I think when you're dealing with any sector workers, if you have an approach with the stick, people will find ways to leave. And it's about incentivising people to work here, have a good life, and actually be positive within the classroom.
It's about giving
when there's
back
huge issues around morale, it affects everybody. And I think we need a broader conversation, not only pay, but actually around accommodation and around transport costs, because you need to give teachers an opportunity to have a positive morale within the workplace.
Surely we're giving teachers, Anne's point is nothing but opportunity, Minister. We're giving them almost free education. I know you have to invest an awful lot personally, but nothing compared to
we've doubled the cost and
doubled
the years for the master's programme, for example. That could be reversed overnight. That's just a bureaucratic change that increased the time for training and increased the cost. And that's one of the reasons people are emigrating, because they're having to repay those fees over
teachers
time.
Teachers fund that period.
And they fund that period, the master's programme.
Can we juxtapose this as well? And this is not a different conversation. In a way, it's the thought and attention, Minister, given by the government to teachers, a cohort within the public sector, as opposed to soldiers and the army. And they're complaining for a long time now about poor rates of pay, and nothing seems to be done about it.
Well, I mean, that's not the case. And if I could go back to, because it was touched on here about the pay inequality, and obviously there's a huge amount of work being done. The Public Sector Stability Act or agreement, which will be finalised or which is finishing at the end of next year, will see 90% of pay restored, and I think that's extremely important to acknowledge. Anybody under 70,000, I'm not saying it was good in the first instance that it had to happen, and we all know why that had to happen, but it will be restored, and that will happen by the end of next year. We need that to reach 100%, and we need to see that everybody's poor pay is restored.
But talk to me about soldiers and why they're still being paid poorly according to themselves. They say, look, a decision was made by government this week to send Irish soldiers to Mali, which is a very, very dangerous situation, and they're being paid badly, they say.
Well, I mean, there's two issues you've raised there. The issue and the decision, and again, this will come under the triple lock, so it's obviously something that the Minister himself and the Department have looked at, but it will have to be agreed and approved by the government, and it will be debated on its merits and not. This is about, I think, redeploying 14 troops from our Rangers. It's over a two-year period. It's changing every 4 months within that two-year period, and it's about creating stability in the Western African region. And as part of our overall foreign policy, that's a huge priority for us, particularly in terms of our development aid, which we've tripled in recent years. I do acknowledge, and we all acknowledge, and this is why it's taken a lot of time to look at the merits and the challenges of this. It's a very difficult and complex region. You have criminality, you have smuggling, you have terrorism.
Can I bring you back
have
to the
all
rates
of these
pay?
Issues?
Because we are quick to laud, and ministers and the government, rightly so, quick to laud soldiers who work in the Mediterranean, for example, scooping bodies sometimes up in traumatic situations, migrants who've travelled across. And yet, I look at the rates of pay here. A corporal in the army is paid €30,000, I think.
Soldiers should be paid for the work that they do. And we all, again, have family members and friends, and we respect the work that they do and the fact that they represent our country. And yes, they should be paid.
Paid
but the
what?
Public service agreement, which is in place, which has been agreed by all of us, is currently in place. And if we were to start picking certain elements of it...
Are you standing behind that then? Are you saying that's what was agreed and that's what I endorse?
No, what I'm saying is we have a number of things happening at the moment to try and address the concerns. So the issue of recruitment and retention isn't just teachers or nurses, it's the Defence Forces. They are some of our most skilled people in this country.
I mean, the recruitment and retention crisis within the Defence Forces.
Let me finish my point, please.
But is that, the most skilled is getting €30,000 a year, is that right?
We need to make sure that it comes in line with the public service agreement that's currently in place. We have a public service stability agreement, and we also have a mechanism in place to address and to try and look at the fact that we have recruitment.
Are you willing to say that the rates of pay within the armed forces is wrong?
What I'm saying is they need to increase in line with everybody else, but we also need to look at other measures. No, that's why we have a review in place. That's why the Public Service Commission, which you agreed with as part of the Competence and Supply.
The Defence Forces.
Sorry, but I need to finish my point. Can I speak, Minister?
You haven't reflected the unique nature of the Defence Forces. They're subject to civil and military law. They can't join a trade union. They can't go on strike. They can be called at any time, 365 days a year. What we need to do here is seriously address the decimation. We're at a cliff edge for our Defence Forces.
Wasn't there a deal for the guards?
There was, absolutely.
Same thing. Well, you supported that deal, isn't it?
Well, I'm supporting if we'd a motion the Dáil last week to restore allowances to pre-FEMPI levels, and that can be done in the context of the historic nature of allowances for the Defence Forces. If you look at the submission from military management, they have said there's an absolute retention crisis, that we are at the point of no return. If you look at the effective strength...
But the Minister, in fairness, were in Fine Gael. They're trying to hold the line. Can I say what the Minister...
Fine Gael and government like to use the army as a prop for photo opportunities, but they don't treat them with the loyalty, dignity and the respect that they show to this country at home and abroad. And I think what we need to see happening is an absolute restoration of allowances, because unless it happens, we saw last year the ships couldn't go to sea, the Air Corps couldn't get a crew to go to Donegal for the gorse fires, and what the minister needs to do, Pascal Donoghue tried to use the Defence Forces as a means to attack Fianna Fáil this week when there were serious questions about his own prudence and management of the economy, and that was...
Do you think Fine Gael is targeting the armed forces then?
I think Fine Gael is using the Defence Forces to deflect from its own mismanagement of public expenditure. The Defence Forces isn't responsible for the Children's Hospital. It's not responsible for broadband. It's not responsible for Leo Varadkar's $3 billion tax pledge that he made. What we need to do is show dignity and respect and restore their allowances, because if we don't, like we have, if you read the 2017 UL report...
You're being completely hypocritical here. We have a public sector stability agreement, which they will be in line with, and the same as the other public sector.
How is it hypocritical?
Payments.
What about the Gardaí?
Please hold on two seconds. We have a public sector stability agreement. We also have a public sector pay commission, which you agreed with as part of the confidence and supply agreement, which, by the way, when it was reviewed only last year, not once was this issue...
Let me speak for two seconds.
I didn't interrupt you.
You did, actually.
It wasn't for one second raised when we reviewed all of this. The public sector pay commission is looking at this. We've had verbal and written consultations with the Defence Forces, with the Chief of Staff, with the Chief of Staff has had to make a public plea about this issue.
Vice Admiral Mark Mellott has had to make a public plea because he's been thrown under a bus by the Minister for Defence.
Can I just say, all of the recommendations made
by military management were butchered and taken out of the report by the Minister and the Department of Defence.
So the integrity
of the public pay commission process has been completely
Can I address the issue of the public pay commission, because this has constantly been rammed down my throat. I first spoke on military pay on the 10th of October 2014. I've engaged with PD Fora and RACO, the two representative bodies, since I got elected to the Senate. Now, the Department of Defence has the public service recommendations for several weeks now. So what is the holdup? Stop telling me that the public service pay is going to solve the problem. You have it for several weeks. And I have to say, in deference, Jack has been a tremendous supporter of the Defence Forces, but they are supporting Fine Gael. If Fianna Fáil wanted in the morning, they could make this a confidence and supply issue.
Surely they can't let any group within the agreement leapfrog another group.
Leapfrogging has been taking place all along. So it has the fire officers, the police, the nurses. But bear in mind, when the low-hanging fruit was to be taken at the start of the crisis, they took all of the allowances off the Defence Forces. That is not core pay.
Across the public service, though, wasn't it? Not quite as deep,
and there weren't as many allowances.
Well, that's what every group says in the public service. Listen, I
represented the teachers for years. I would be the first person to say we do not respect and pay our teachers, but we are absolutely... 3,500 soldiers have left. You talk about bringing experience home. We've driven 3,500 out. We have 9 ships, 7 crews. We are in dire straits.
A texter, John Lonergan, says, an infantry private who worked for me left the army because he couldn't afford to drive to work, was living with his parents, no chance of saving for a mortgage deposit. He left the army to cut turf because it paid better. Yeah, I don't know if that's typical.
But there's no, I don't think there's any argument about it. The defence forces in my lifetime have been neglected and have always been neglected, and their pay has been absolutely outrageously insulting to people who are there to serve the common good and are there when emergencies arrive. I just want to make a point, Cormac, because it's very important. 10 years ago, about the start of all this trouble started when the economy collapsed, and where was the biggest anger and attack? On the public service, right across the spectrum. We are now beginning to pay the price of the consequences of that, because, for instance, with teachers, anyone that will go into a secondary school and a primary school and talk to teachers, what is still the biggest single grievance? The Croke Park hours, the 30 hours, lunatic hours, lunacy hours. It embittered thousands of teachers, because teachers were given their time anyway, going to play sport, doing all sorts of extra duties, and then there were these compulsory 30 hours. I often am asked actually to go to talk to teachers, and I always ask, what are they on the Croke Park hours? Because every time I go, I know the atmosphere in the room. These are hours that we just hate to be here, and little things like that, Cormac, have a massive consequences down the line in relation to teaching or the army being attractive, because these are the things that put people off.
It's about quality of life, I suppose.
It's about respect as well.
A texter says, I'm an Irish teacher. I had to leave a permanent job in Dublin due to the cost of rent. I'm living in Donegal now. The quality of life is so much better. At least Minister Joe McHugh will be happy about that one. The quality of life in Donegal is much better, he says, that texter. Anyway, we'll discuss Boris Johnson and his race to become the leader. You might have to deal with him, Minister, and give him a warning. We'll see what she says to Boris Johnson across the airwaves in just a second.
Text 51551. Saturday with Cormac O'Hara on RTE Radio 1. Saturday with Cormac O'Hara on RTE Radio 1.
Now, there are 6 people in the race to become the leader of the Tory party in the UK and, ipso facto, Prime Minister. You might have to deal with Boris Johnson if his momentum continues. He's saying, and they're all saying really, that we could drop the backstop, that the UK could drop the backstop clause in the Brexit deal, or else he'd walk away and there'd be no deal. Is he a bluffer?
Well, I mean, it's worrying whether it's Boris Johnson or any other candidates who seem to have focused in on, and I don't want to get into too much detail, but honed in on the idea that they would change or remove or go back to the EU and renegotiate essentially what's taken 2.5 years to negotiate. The answer and the response from the EU has always been the same, irrespective of who the Prime Minister is. This is the deal that we've negotiated.
So Boris is bluffing, is he?
He's saying what he's saying, the same as any other candidate is putting forward their own proposals. But what's clear, irrespective of what he or anybody else says, is that even if there were to be a no deal, that to come back and to re-engage with the European Union, they would still have to address the 3 key issues: citizens' rights, financial settlement and the Irish issue. So I think what's important is that we have a Prime Minister elected, that we obviously engage with them, and we will, myself and whoever's dealing with them, the Taoiseach of course most importantly, but the European Union is not going to change its position just because there is a new Prime Minister. And I think we've been very clear, as has the EU been very clear in saying that.
A new leader can bring a new energy and a new momentum. I'm sure you've dealt with Boris Johnson when he was minister.
I've met with him a few times. With many of the other candidates a number of times as well, but irrespective of whether they have a new momentum, whether they have a new parliament, whether they have a new cabinet, a new minister for Brexit, or a new prime minister, there won't be any change in terms of the agreement.
You cannot be that impenetrable as a negotiation team. Surely his charm and his wit... Look at her laughing.
You said that.
Why are you laughing at that?
I'm not. I mean, irrespective of who it is or what charm they bring, whether it's male or female, although we know it'll be male, it's not going to change the fact that these negotiations have concluded, that there's been compromise on both sides, that Theresa May herself was part of a very strong negotiating team, and I think there's a suggestion
Theresa May didn't have the charm or the wit of Boris Johnson.
That's a personal opinion
Ireland's and the EU's negotiating team would wilt under his powers.
I think, look, Boris Johnson, from what I've seen, he's chaotic, totally chaotic and eccentric, quite unstable. Actually, I remember if you look back at the DUP conference earlier on this year, he said he'd be against the withdrawal agreement, assured everyone in the room, and 3 days later he voted for it. So I think Boris Johnson is trying to promote this personality politics against the institution of the EU, but also Whitehall and the civil service in the UK, and the express will of the British Parliament is against a no deal.
Sure,
so it's all just bluff and bluster. But I think, it going back to the serious point, we are on the cliff edge here. It's obviously, we're out to Halloween in terms of the withdrawal agreement. The basis for the extension was actually that it wouldn't be reopened. The context of it wouldn't be reopened. So I think Ireland needs to continue to prepare. Well, we need to adhere to what IFAC have said this week in terms of the fiscal warnings, and Ireland needs to ramp up its preparations for any eventuality, because anything is possible with Boris Johnson as Prime Minister.
The Taoiseach said this morning that they're preparing two versions of a budget, one in the face of a no deal, and one, and I assume that the agreement with Fianna Fáil stands, another budget no matter what, even if it is a hard deal.
Well, we've been constructive and responsible throughout the last 3 years, and I think that's been the right thing to do for the country in the context of what's going on across the water. And I think when you compare the two parliaments, at least the centre ground in Ireland has stood strong in the face of very difficult international situation for the country.
Niamh Hourigan, he'd be a tough old cookie to deal with, wouldn't he, Boris Johnson?
I'm not sure he will. I mean, he has elements of him which are quite like Trump in this kind of trickster piece, where he constantly tries to wrong foot people and has this unpredictability about him. But I'm inclined to agree with Helen in the sense that I think that the EU negotiating team will see him off without too much difficulty. I suppose my bigger concern about the whole Brexit debate and the way it's going in the UK is the general, I suppose, greater support for the no deal in the debate itself and amongst all the candidates. And certainly I think the outcome of the European elections, where, you know, Farage did get quite a significant vote, I think it has changed the tone of the debate, particularly on the Remain side. I think they have become less assertive in some ways in this debate, and that would concern me. I would have a concern that there's a no deal momentum emerging in the UK that is going to become quite difficult, I think, in this broader horizon that we're facing into at the end of October.
In a way, the negotiation has fatigued everyone. Gerard Croffle, they're saying, like, even in the UK you hear people say, look, to hell with it, let's get out at this stage, but that means a hard border on the island.
Let me be straight. There are three concerns here. The first is the Good Friday Agreement in Northern Ireland. The second is the integrity of the single market. And I've been saying this since the day of the referendum. There will be a border on the island of Ireland. There was never a hard border in the history of this state. But we did have a highly militarised border during the Troubles period. There will be a border, and the government have to come out and have to come clean and explain to the people of Ireland and the wider people of Europe how they intend to protect the single market. Because if one carcass of beef finds its way through the UK that has in some way been genetically modified and finds its way onto a table in Paris or in Berlin, our entire beef market will fall apart. We cannot, and I said this the day after the referendum and I stand over it today, we cannot ignore the issue of the border. I don't care what...
But we're not. That's why the backstop clause is there.
We're being told there will be no border. There will be no border on the island of Ireland. Will somebody please explain to me how we protect the integrity of the single market where we have an open border with a third country?
Well, we've been down this road before, haven't we? Even with you, Minister, on this programme. If there is a no deal, there's going to be a border, isn't that right?
Well, I think I'd like to hear Senator Crockwell tell people where the border is and how we're going to impose it. We've always said that that won't be the case, that we won't allow that to happen come hell or high water. We've also said, and it's very difficult, of course, to deal with both, that we will protect the single market because we're not leaving. We're not going anywhere. We
how
will
do
remain
you do the
part
two?
Of that. It's very difficult. It's very difficult,
you
and we
have,
are...
You can't have checks at our ports. If you do, you place Ireland outside the European Union. So you cannot use our ports in Dublin, Rosslare, Cork or wherever. The only checks can be at the border.
The way that we do it is the way in which we have negotiated. And you might say it hasn't been agreed, it hasn't been approved. It took 2.5 years to negotiate the backstop. That's not something that we're going to walk away from. And I heard this morning a suggestion, well, if you don't have a deal, you don't have the backstop. But if
but
you don't have the backstop as part of an overall agreement, you have nothing. And irrespective of whether there's a no deal, if there is a no deal, the UK aren't going to walk away and say we're going to have nothing to do with the EU ever again. If they come back and engage with us, they will have to address citizens' rights, financial settlement and the backstop.
Okay.
So there is no reason for us to walk away.
We'll be enlightened tomorrow because the first debate among the contenders to be leader of the Tory party happens, I think, on Channel 4, although Boris won't be there, Boris Johnson. But we'll see. Anyway, Feicim Mhuire Linn, Muíochas Leis an Aire, Minister Helen McEntee, Jack Chambers, Gerard Crochwell, Professor Niamh Hourigan and John Lonergan. Gují, Jé Sáharan, Jo Hogan, Arrivederci.
Saturday with Cormac O'Hara was produced by Tom Donnelly. Research was by A.B. Philbin Bowman. The broadcast coordinator was David Phelan, and Pather Kearney was on sound.